game, much like artificial intelligence, robotics, and other technologies of the future. But TikTok has one big advantage, 170 million votes. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 19, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, and Birdie. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Faraz Siddiqui, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, and Eric Galatas. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. Where I live in the Coast Range, I'm surrounded in all directions by industrial timber plantations for miles and miles around. And I want to say right at the outset, I have no problem with logging. We at the Coast Range Association think silviculture is a good and noble profession. But it is plain for anyone to see that the short rotation, financialized plantation management practiced by the Wall Street investors who own the vast majority of private timberland in the Northwest is destroying our communities and ecosystems. The Coast Range Association has been highlighting the need for an alternative model of forest management that sustains both economies and ecosystems for decades. So when I heard about today's guest's research into community forests, I was all ears. Alexander Harris is the Land and Water Policy Manager at the Bellingham-based nonprofit Resources. Alexander recently completed a graduate program in environmental policy at Western Washington University, where his research explored how community-driven forest stewardship can help restore watersheds. I learned so much from this conversation, but there was a lot I couldn't fit into the radio version of the show. So if you want to hear the full interview, find Coast Range Radio on any podcast app or listen at our website, coastrange.org, and make sure to keep supporting your community radio station. You can email me anytime with questions, guest ideas, recipes, whatever, at michael@coastrange.org. Okay, Alexander Harris, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Alexander, I've been really looking forward to this conversation ever since you presented your research at our Forest Over Profits conference last fall. And there is a lot I want to talk with you about, but let's start with the basics. What does the term community forestry mean to you?
Well, community forests are, there's really no one single model of a community forest. And I think a lot of people struggle to have a clear definition of what a community forest is, because the basic idea is that the community defines that for themselves. It's a forest that's usually owned by a community entity locally, whether that's a nonprofit or a city or a county, and it's managed on behalf of the community. So you can just imagine there are a wide variety of different models that communities have used to manage their forests, depending on the different goals that those different communities have. So community forestry more broadly is this movement that's especially gaining traction in the Northwest where folks are saying, instead of this paradigm of lock up forests and protect them, never log them again, or give them over to these multinational timber corporations to log to the bone, there is a middle ground that we need to explore where we can be producing wood products in perpetuity, high quality wood products, putting people to work, while also looking at the long-term health of the community, the long-term health of the ecosystem, and moving the needle on conservation through active forest management. That's kind of the big picture idea of community forests, but every community forest goes about that in different ways.
Well, thanks for that overview. I appreciate that. So I have never done a master's research paper, but from reading yours, I can tell you put a tremendous amount of time into this. So what interests you in this subject of community forestry enough to devote that much time to studying it?
Well, I grew up in Southern Oregon in the town of Ashland, and I didn't really know this while I was growing up, but Ashland is this hub of forestry innovation that, kind of was always the background of my growing up down there. But I didn't really get involved in forestry work till I moved north and lived in Eugene and then eventually Portland and worked for Oregon Wild and Sierra Club. But there was a seed planted from the community I grew up in. And in Ashland, there used to be rampant clear-cut logging throughout Ashland's drinking watershed. And it degraded the timber resource. It made the forests unnaturally dense and homogenous, and it contributed to a lot of landslides. And so a lot of Ashlanders back in the 80s and 90s came together and really put a lot of pressure on the Forest Service to say, hey, cut it out. Stop logging in our watershed. And there was a long history here. I won't get into the details, but essentially a compromise was found where the Forest Service would continue to manage those forests for timber production, but they would do so with these special considerations for fire and for water. And so what you see now in the Ashland watershed is, a thinning regime, which some people say is still too aggressive, but compared to where it used to be, it's night and day different. I mean, it's ecological forestry in practice, where you have wildfire mitigation techniques being used. You're thinning out forests from below. You're taking out the smaller diameter trees. You're opening up those stands. These are ponderosa pine mixed conifer stands. And so they're very different than what we have in Western Oregon, Western Washington. So they're really looking at like the ecology of the place, the fire history of the place, and managing accordingly, which is kind of textbook ecological forestry. And it's still, it's not benign. There's still management and roads. And it's not to say that it's a complete win for the environment, but it's moved the needle on conservation while still putting people to work in the woods. And to me, that's a great example of a community forest type project. And it's just really cool that I grew up in a place where that was already happening.
Well, let's talk about your research paper then, Restoring the Nooksack Watershed Through Community-Driven Forestry. So could you just give us like the executive summary style overview of the paper? And then I want to dig in and ask you about the specific pieces of it.
Right. So the Nooksack Watershed is a major river in Cascadia. It's located just south of the Canadian border, and it runs out of the North Cascades, which are the most glaciated part of the lower 48. And the Nooksack Watershed is an undammed system. There's no dams on our river, which makes it exceptional in the Northwest. And frankly, in the larger American West, most of our rivers have dams on them. So the Nooksack actually still supports all five species of salmon, as well as steelhead and cutthroat trout, bull trout, other fish. And historically, those fish have been the backbone of local tribal economies and cultures. And they still are to this day. We have two tribes up here that are still very active in fisheries management, the Nooksack Tribe and Lummi Nation. And over the years, they've made a lot of progress in restoring salmon habitat in the rivers. There's been a lot of log jams constructed in our rivers. There's been a lot of levee setbacks and riparian restoration. But it became clear that in-stream restoration can only go so far in recovering fish. In fact, the main degrading land use in some of these portions of the Nooksack watershed was forestry. The clear-cut logging, clear-cut plantation model of the 1950s onward completely transformed this watershed. And it led to higher and higher flows in the winter, which carved out our rivers, disconnected them from their historic floodplain, straightened out our rivers. So they're less meandering and less sinuous. They're much more like freeways for water. And it leads to lower stream flows in the summer. So we're seeing, you know, forestry has contributed to a change in the hydrology of our rivers. And in order to actually recover fish, you need to recover hydrologic function. And in order to do that, you need to get at the root of the problem, which is how the vast majority of the landscape is managed. And of course, here, the vast majority of the landscape is forested. So forestry has always been at the center of this. It's just been a really tough nut to crack. And I'm sure you're very familiar with this in your other interviews. Private industrial timber companies have a lot of political power. They have strong legal arguments to say, you know, we have full autonomy over what we do on our own land. And so to actually regulate them and improve forestry practices is really difficult. Community forestry is a way of sidestepping that difficulty somewhat by just buying the land outright, buying land from private timber companies, putting it into the ownership of communities, and then getting those communities to figure out for themselves how the land should be managed to accomplish multiple objectives. And so that was the focus of my research paper. It was identifying the promise of this model, but then also kind of spelling out some next steps and how our local community could scale this up. If we only do it on 500 acres or 1,000 acres, it won't contribute to the kind of watershed recovery that we need. We need to scale this up so that it is truly a watershed scale approach towards restoration. And in order to do that, you need strong community involvement. You need it to be democratic and economically sustainable. So that was really what the paper focused on. And I'm proud to say, you know, we are currently seeing the Stewart Mountain Community Forest make some strides and towards scaling up. And it's happening right in front of our eyes. It's happening in real time. So I really think our community can be a positive example for other communities in the Northwest for how to get this work done. And of course, each community will want to adapt the model, but hopefully we can provide a template that is at least somewhat helpful.
So I'm glad that you talked a little bit about kind of the hydrology, because I think a lot of people don't understand. A lot of people can see viscerally, you clear cut an area around a watershed and you can see immediate impacts. Something we might not have time to dig too deeply into today is those long lasting impacts that you don't necessarily see, but that happen on that generational scale.
Right.
I actually want to jump forward. I would love to hear the other thing that you did in this research paper, which we'll link to in our show notes, and you can tell folks how to find it if you want, is you looked at several different case studies of different specific community forests in Washington especially. I would love to talk about each of those if we have time, but since you brought up Stewart Mountain, let's just jump right into, you know, the kind of base reason for a lot of this research in the first place was it seems like you were trying to help develop some recommendation and direction for that project. So talk about the Stewart Mountain Forest Initiative, what the genesis was, and what the state is now.
Right. So there are three major forks to the Nooksack River. The North and Middle Fork run off of the most glaciated part of the watershed, and they're very cold in the summer, and they generally have a decent stream flow. The South Fork is the watershed that has effectively no glaciers left in it. All the glaciers have already left, and it is the most endangered of the three rivers. It also is supporting a spring Chinook population that is threatened to be extinct, and it's extremely important to the local tribes and commercial fishermen who depend on that Chinook fishery. And so the South Fork has always been a major priority for restoration. And like I was saying before, there was a certain limit to what could be accomplished in stream for restoration. And eventually, a handful of entities identified Stewart Mountain as a priority for reformed forest management. Stewart Mountain is located about 10-15 miles east of Bellingham, and Stewart Mountain runs alongside the South Fork Nooksack River. And potentially the goal was to acquire this mountain and put it into community ownership and set it on a track of long-term recovery. The question was how to accomplish that goal, because mm-hmm. that's easier said than done.
Right.
And so these partners came together. It was the Nooksack Tribe, Whatcom County, Whatcom Land Trust, and Evergreen Land Trust. Those four partners came together and decided to buy this forest, put it into community ownership, and set up some type of governance structure to make sure that decisions that are made are done so fairly and that those decisions are sustainable long term, both environmentally sustainable, but also economically sustainable. It's crucially important that a community forest can pay for itself. You can't just rely on grant funds in perpetuity. And so that was the goal. My paper dived into these case examples so that we could look at how other community forests have threaded that needle. And we looked at three in particular, the Nisqually Community Forest, the Tiehnawae Community Forest, and the Nason Ridge Community Forest. And each of those is owned by a different entity and has a different governance structure and a different management regime. And so we could learn from the different tweaks to this model that either were advantageous or, as I learned, some of these models were disadvantageous. And so we can kind of learn like what we want to do and what we don't want to do. Like what do we want to avoid, right? And so we learned those things. I made recommendations to the management team that's in charge of moving this all forward. And it was a super helpful resource for them.
You're touching on, I think, all of the key complexities of this whole concept. Could you talk about some of those lessons from that kind of big picture? Like if somebody is hearing this and is interested in this endeavor, you know, what are some of the lessons that you think people should be thinking about from the outset, or just interesting lessons that you learned through the course of this project?
Right. Well, if someone's listening to this and they're interested in getting a community forest established in their neck of the woods, there are a handful of resources I would recommend. But one of them would be to read a portion, at least, of my paper. And that portion would be the case examples. And just reading these profiles on these three different community forests. If it's all right, I'll just walk through each of the three and just kind of highlight lessons learned from those in case that's helpful.
Yeah. And real quick, where do people find this paper? And right. I do recommend everybody read the whole thing. It's very readable. It's very well put together.
So if you just Google my name, Alexander Harris, and you type in Western Washington University and you type in community forest, you're probably going to find it. There it is. Restoring the Nooksack watershed through community-driven forestry. So that was my thesis. And you also can, you know, link to it in the show notes, but
yeah.
Yeah, so the three case examples, my favorite of all the community forests I've ever heard of is called the Nisqually Community Forest, located right between Olympia and Tacoma. That's where the Nisqually comes into the Salish Sea, and it's up in the foothills of Mount Rainier in this patchwork of private industrial timberland that's been managed very aggressively over the years and contributed to a lot of watershed problems for salmon recovery. So really what the work we're doing here in the Nooksack is maybe about 10 years behind what they're doing in the Nisqually. Hmm. We're kind of just following in their footsteps
mm-hmm.
because they're on the cutting edge of this discussion. They worked with the EPA to model how industrial logging was degrading summer streamflow, how it was contributing to less and less water in the late summer, which is when fish and farmers and everyone else needs water the most. They were using research that was conducted at Oregon State, Perry and Jones' 2017 paper on long-term forestry impacts. And then there's another paper from 2020, Segura et al. 2020. Those are both easily findable if anyone's interested. But both of those papers showed that industrial logging, when you clear cut and replant a dense plantation, that contributes to a 50% reduction in summer streamflow when compared to adjacent unlogged watersheds. So that's huge. I mean, 50% is nothing short of dramatic. And if we can even tweak that dial slightly towards a more naturally functioning system, we're going to see more water in our rivers and in our streams in late summer. And so the Nisqually folks, they picked up that research. They worked with EPA to calibrate it to the Nisqually. They found some really impressive results. And then they went for grants that said, you know, we're basically going to address this issue through improved forestry, through ecological forest management. The groups involved are the Nisqually Tribe, the Nisqually River Council, and the Nisqually Land Trust. So it's a really innovative approach, and it was by far the most exciting. The next community forest north is known as the Tianaway. The Tianaway is 52,000 acres, a very large area, and it's owned and managed by the state of Washington. So the Department of Natural Resources is in charge of managing this land, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife has a conservation easement on that land. So really interesting structure of like intergovernmental collaboration. There's also a robust stakeholder engagement regime where stakeholders from recreation and from nearby municipalities and from conservation groups and from the industry, they all work together to kind of make decisions about how the forest should be managed. Of course, there's drawbacks because it's government. It's big, it's clunky, it's slow. And then the third case example is the Nason Ridge Community Forest. It's the newest community forest in the Northwest, and it's located along Lake Chelan. It's owned by a county. There's involvement from a variety of other stakeholders. And it's really, I think, a promising model to get a county involved because they're just on the ground and they're more able to kind of interface with different stakeholders and apply for grants and do that kind of work. So yeah, those are the three case examples I studied. Each of them have their advantages and disadvantages. And I kind of recommended a collection of different things from each of those examples for the Stewart Mountain Community Forest.
One thing that really comes out through the course of this paper is how, as you touched on before, there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution here. Some communities are going to prioritize financial return over recreation or conservation. Some folks are going to prioritize recreation. Some folks are going to prioritize stream restoration for salmonid species or other things. So I think that is, as you point out, you know, a benefit and can be a potential drawback to these. But it is important to understand that there are as many ways to constitute a community forest as there are communities, which overall I think is one of the exciting things about them.
Right.
Let's talk about, I do want to hear more about the lessons that you learned. Let's talk about some of the challenges. You know, you touched on one of the big challenges is that, well, first of all, financing at the outset is going to be a challenge for anyone, right? And then for entities that are going to need financial return through logging off these landscapes, most of them are going to be degraded landscapes. A lot of them are not going to have marketable timber. You know, we don't have time to get into all of the nitty-gritty there, but what are some of the challenges that you see community forests facing and how they deal with that kind of at that overview level?
Yeah, there are various challenges. The biggest challenge is acquiring the land and having the funds to adequately manage that land. I think a lot of people underestimate the complexity of forest management just in general and assume that, hey, if we just stopped logging, it would just all get better, right? Like we should just stop logging and it'll all recover. And there's just a lot of ignorance, frankly, in certain circles about like the damage that's been done and the work that's needed to recover from that damaged state. And that means we need chainsaws and feller bunchers involved in restoring these dense, homogeneous timber plantations because they're not functioning ecosystems. I mean, especially the Oregon Coast Range, God, like that, there's no other place on earth that looks like the Oregon Coast Range. There's not even anywhere in Washington looks anything like it because it's just a sacrifice zone to the timber industry. And you can't just walk away from a problem like that. It requires decades of commitment to recover. And that recovery is expensive. It doesn't always pencil out. So there needs to be a way to recover these ecosystems while paying for that recovery work. That's kind of the ideal metabolism of a community forest to get to a point where the money that's going into restoration and into acquisition of land is coming from the management of the land base. And it's a self-sustaining cycle. The challenge is getting to that place because it usually takes 10 or 20 years to get there. And so that's why you need front-end public investment in community forestry to get us to that model, because it is doable. It is possible to be generating wood products and to leave a forest behind. But to get to that sustainable thinning regime, you need a transition. You need a bridge. And so that to me is the biggest hurdle, is building this bridge in a way that is financially stable and you know, making sure that community forests are operating at the right economy of scale, which is basically the concept of, you can't just have like 40 acres as a community forest. Like, that's just not going to work. Right. Because if you do one or two thinnings in that stand, like, you have to wait 20 years before you do anything else. So the bigger the area, the more options you have, the more revenue generation opportunities you have. And that's usually is a better way to balance those books. But to get a lot of land, it requires more front-end investment. And where does that money come from? You know what I mean? So that's the bridge that needs to be built. And it's been frustrating to see that bottleneck hold back so many good projects.
Right.
Fortunately, in Washington, there's now a community forest program where the state is investing millions of dollars every biennium into communities being able to buy their own timberland and set up community forests. And Stewart Mountain has received that grant. A handful of other community forests in Western Washington have also received it. The program's only, I think, 2 years old. But I would definitely recommend exploring that in Oregon at some point, to create a program, a pot of money for communities to kind of get jump started on this path towards community forestry.
Yeah. Actually, I've been wanting to find someone who was involved in the creation of that to reach out to. I think that would be a great follow-up episode to this one, because I do agree that that is a missing piece of the puzzle here in Oregon.
Right.
And we at the Coast Range Association have long held the belief that the only way to create this alternative community benefit forest model is through those massive public investments up front.
Right.
Is there anything that we've missed that you want to get included in this conversation? And I also want to see if what your recommendation would be for how listeners can learn more about community forestry and get involved with this movement.
Right. Well, I would say community forestry is a topic that you're probably going to hear more and more about in the future. If you haven't heard of them yet, check out the Northwest Community Forest Coalition. And there's a good website. They have a bunch of resources and fact sheets, stuff like that, maps on their website. And they also are, you know, looking to grow their influence in the Northwest. So if you're interested in being a member of that coalition, you should reach out to them. That would be my recommendation there. One other thing maybe I would love to leave the listener with is, when we're talking about forest management conversations, we need to remember there are so many trade-offs associated with all of these decisions. We should avoid the black and white dichotomy of all logging is bad or logging is the best thing ever and we should do as much of it as we can. Both of those dichotomies will not work. They are not functional. We need to instead embrace, like truly embrace, ecological forest management as our baseline goal. And ecological forestry, as defined by Jerry Franklin and his colleagues, is an opportunity to look at a forest as an ecosystem and manage it for numerous benefits. Community forests, to me, are just a means towards that end. And if folks are interested in learning more about that, we have a YouTube video. We got to hang out with Jerry Franklin, this famous forest ecologist, for the day in the H.J. Andrews Experimental Forest in Oregon. And we interviewed him about what ecological forestry is. It's a 10-minute video. If you just Google Jerry Franklin ecological forestry, it will be the most viewed video of his on YouTube. We made it like a year ago, and it's, I think, really great introduction to this topic. Just wanted to throw that out there so people can have more nuanced conversations as they're debating with the timber industry or their neighbors or whatever, just to talk about the different ways to manage a forest that are not falling into the black and white dichotomy that we're oftentimes presented with.
Well, Alexander, you are speaking my language right there. I love to hear that. That is what I preach all the time. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. But I really appreciate you joining me today. And yeah, I hope that we get to talk again soon. Congratulations on this research. And how lucky and special that not only did you get to do this research, but you're actually putting it in practice. It's not just sitting there gathering dust. So congratulations to you. Thank you so much for your work. And thanks for joining us on Coast Range Radio.
Yeah, thanks for the conversation.
And that's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Thanks so much to Alexander Harris. You can find links to everything we talked about today in the show notes of the podcast or at our website on coastrange.org. You can hear an extended version of this conversation on our podcast feed. And one more time, make sure to subscribe or follow Coast Range Radio on any podcast app to get all of our episodes. You can learn more about the Coast Range Association at coastrange.org. One more time, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO